Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering functional stoneware, hand-carved boxes, meditation statuary, candles, and incense. International Galleries also offers custom framing services for your fine art print, photos, needlework, and fabric art. Rush service is always available. Programming on WILL is made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting the concluding concert of the 20th season, featuring Beethoven's extraordinary Ninth Symphony and Fantasy for piano, chorus, and orchestra. The U of I Chamber Singers and Oratorio Society join Sinfonia on Saturday, May 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. For more information, call 333-6280.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Let me mention very quickly that tomorrow morning in the first hour, we'll be talking about Africa. Our guest will be Howard French, senior writer for the New York Times. We'll talk about his recent book titled A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa. Then in hour two, we'll talk with Jeffrey Hollander. He is the CEO of Seventh Generation, and we'll be talking about his book, What Matters Most, and here the subtitle will sort of tell you what it's about. It is titled, How a Small Group of Pioneers is Teaching Social Responsibility to Big Business and Why Big Business is Listening. That is tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of Focus 580, we will review some of the history of World War I. Our guest for the show is Hugh Strawn. He is a fellow of All Souls College at Oxford University, and he has written a lot about World War I. He's the editor of the Oxford History of the First World War. He is currently involved in writing a 3-volume history of the First World War. The first volume was published in 2001 and was well received. If you're interested in learning more about World War I and you're looking for a 1-volume book, something that might be just a little bit more manageable, you should look for another of his books, and it is titled The First World War. It's published here in the United States by Viking, and it was produced as a companion to a television series on First World War that was done in Britain. And again, it has been well received. If you'd like to have something to read about the war that will fit reasonably in one hand, you could look for that book. And then, of course, if you're interested in reading in greater detail, obviously you can look at this 3-volume series that he has been working on. He's now spending some time here in the United States talking about the First World War. He is in Denver today and is joining us by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Strawn, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Pleasure.
You know, I think that certainly here in the United States, there are many people who will remember World War II and who fought in World War II.
Sure.
But for a lot of people, World War I will be as much ancient history as our Civil War, probably. And the extent of it, the impact of it, is something that I think people just don't, they have no way to grab onto it. And actually, one of the things that I wondered about was in Britain, whether there are people who still feel the impact of the First World War in a way. I would think here in the United States, there would be very few people who would.
I think that's one of the big differences between the two countries. You're absolutely right. That it is a blip here and between the Civil War and the Second World War. In Britain, it's exactly the other way around. For Britain, this war involved greater loss of life than the Second World War. It defined what war means to many people, still does define what war means to many people. That's partly because of the casualties and partly also because of the influence of the war poets, people like Wilfred Owen and so on, that the First World War has a resonance which I think Americans probably find very hard and understandably hard to grasp.
Yeah. Well, and I think that if you look at, I wouldn't claim to be a military historian, but certainly one has to acknowledge that in many ways, in the number of individuals who were killed and the kind of military technology that was used, World War One was a quantum leap from what had gone before. Now, I think some people might be prepared to argue that really maybe the first modern war might indeed be the American Civil War, because certainly there was also a quantum leap in military technology, say, between that and the Napoleonic Wars. But
yes.
But having said that, what we're talking about here is if looking only at the number of combatants that died, World War One was enormously more destructive, a great leap in casualties and in destructive power from what had happened before.
Absolutely. We're talking about something like 10 million military deaths. And one of the things that I still have no handle on, and I wonder if we will ever have a handle on, is what the level of civilian loss was. Because populations move, particularly on the Eastern Front, in the First World War, as battle ebbs and flows, populations move, particularly in the Balkans. Serbia is the Serb population is driven out as the Germans and Austrians advance in 1915. And of course, there's much dispute about how many Germans, how many Austrians, how many Turks. The British blockade of those powers, the British naval blockade, how many deaths that inflicts. So, you know, there may well be another 10 million to be added in simply in terms of civilian deaths. But I'm plucking a figure out of the air, but a loss in any event.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also, I'm sure it's difficult to disentangle because there were many ripples that went out from that war. Politically speaking, there were, and correct me if I have this wrong, in four of the countries that were combatants in this war, there were revolutions. In 1918, and then of course also in 1918 there was the great influenza outbreak that killed a lot of people.
So
you have to say that there were in addition to the combat, which affected both soldiers and non-combatants, there were all these other things that had profound impacts that were indirect but that were connected.
Yes, the revolutions are clearly connected. I mean, the war brings revolution. And of course, one of the reasons why I think we can see this is not a war that ends all wars, even though those who fought it hope that it might be, is precisely because it can bring about revolution. War can bring about change, and those who want revolution, of course, therefore see war as having positive effects. So the war and the revolution are directly linked. The influenza epidemic is something that comes independently, and it's almost bizarre that you've had this war which is so disastrous for the populations of Europe in particular, but also, a point I make in the book, of course, for the populations of Africa especially as well. And then you have an influenza epidemic which kills more people than the war does. And it's one of the reasons, of course, that it's so hard to be clear about the civilian loss of life, because does the influenza epidemic have a greater impact because people are debilitated by the war and by economic deprivation and by food shortages, or would it have had that impact anyway? The influenza epidemic hits the United States, and the United States civilian population hasn't been affected by the war. So there is this, in some ways, is just a nasty, horrible thing that happens as well as the war, rather than as a direct consequence of the war.
Yeah. Another of the big questions that people ask, and I'm sure I have continued to ask ever since, was when you look at the way that the war started and then how it grew, how many nations were involved, how destructive it was, and how little sense it all made, one wonders, would there have been anyone with the presence of mind and the ability before the war started to say, this war makes no sense, let's not do this?
Yeah. Well, of course, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know you wouldn't have done it after the event. And I don't think any of them would have done it after the event. Although there are statesmen in July 1914 who were talking in apocalyptic terms about this war. I mean, the man who probably can take more blame than anybody else, in my view, that is the German Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, recognizes that when war comes to Europe, the world will never be the same again, and Europe in particular will never be the same again, recognizes that revolution is a very likely consequence of the war. And so does the Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, and so does Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary. All of them are anything other than optimistic about the consequences of this war. And nonetheless, they go ahead. And I think that that shows just how powerful the counter-pressures are, the recognition that actually there are big issues here at stake and that there is no way out.
And another one of these major sort of interesting things that I think that you really try to get across in the book is that while that perhaps, and understandably so, in Britain and France, in Germany, in the United States, when people think about this war, they focus on the Western Front.
Yeah.
And the trench warfare that happened there, and that perhaps people fail to appreciate the fact that it was, as we call it, a world war, that it was indeed a world war, that it also involved Africa, it involved the Middle East, it involved what is now Turkey, and also there, in as much as people think about trench warfare, there was also a very significant naval component. And some people would argue, you know, I had the opportunity a few months back to talk with Mr. Massey about his book,
yep.
Castles of Steel.
Yes.
I think he even makes the argument that that was what was decisive. It was the war that was fought on the sea more than the land. So I think one of the things that you really, in this book, you try to get across, and I'm sure in the series that it comes from, is that people should indeed understand this was a world war. And it was not just about what happened there in France.
Absolutely. In part, it is because Europe is the center of the world in 1914-18, that these European powers, and particularly Britain, France, and Russia, are colonial powers, and when they go to war, then their colonies go to war too. Almost all of Africa is at war from day one, just by virtue of the fact that Africa is colonized. And the war is taken to Africa from Europe. Its effects are immediate. The loss of life among the African soldiers and the African porters, the porters who carried the supplies that enabled these armies to fight, the loss of life is comparable to the loss of life suffered by the British Army on the Western Front. I think the other thing, too, that this war makes clear is that it's very hard to be a neutral. And the United States learns that only too forcefully. That if a war happens on this scale, neutrality becomes a relative concept rather than an absolute one. The United States may wish to stay out of this war, but if it is a trading country and if it has a need to export, then it's going to be very difficult for the United States not to trade with those who are at war and therefore get sucked into the whole economic infrastructure that underpins this war. What happens, of course, is that under British leadership, the allies, Britain, France, and Russia, essentially fund their war effort through Wall Street. They borrow on the U.S. stock market. They use that to buy armaments in the United States, and U.S. business does very well on the back of it. So from the German point of view, although the United States remains neutral until April 1917, in any formal sense, in terms of international law, from the German point of view, that neutrality has gone long since.
We're talking this morning in this first hour, the second hour focus with Hugh Strawn. He's professor of history at Oxford. He has written a lot about the First World War. He has authored a one-volume history of the war that was produced as a companion to a television series produced in Britain of the war. And the title of his book, this book we're talking about, is The First World War. It's published by Viking. So if you're interested in one book that will give you a good overview of the war, you can look for that. And also he is writing a 3-volume history of the First World War. So if you'd like to read in greater depth, you can turn to that. The first volume of that was published in 2001. And I think, is it Two Arms? Is that
that's right.
The title
right.
of that book?
Yeah.
And he's now spending some time here in the United States talking a little bit about his work and about the war. He's in Denver today. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have caller in Champaign to talk with. Let's do that. And line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a bit of a detailed question. I hope you can bear with me. As I understand it, World War One was basically touched off through the failure of a European alliance system between the Axis and Allies. Now, those alliances, my understanding is, were formed decades before the war actually began, and that it was, for a big part of it, the work of Chancellor Bismarck of Germany. And as I understand it, the alliance system that he set up in, say, the 1890s differs from the alliance system that Europe had after he passed away in, say, the 1810s. I was wondering if you could touch on the differences between those two alliance systems, and also if you would comment on if you think that the assassination that happened in the Balkans that was the catalyst for the war, if that happened under the Bismarck system of alliances, do you think that Europe could have possibly prevented the disintegration of that alliance system? And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Right, right. Well, thank you for asking the question. I mean, Bismarck... It's a $64,000 question in many ways about the outbreak of the war, whether Bismarck's removal, he's removed from power in 1890, whether that removes the one person who could actually have been strong enough, essentially, to manage the European international relations. Of course, he's dead by 1914, so he wouldn't have been around even if he'd still been in power. But you can read many accounts where it will be said that the problem of 1914 was there was no Bismarck. There was no one man who had the ability to manage international relations on the level of the whole of Europe. Having said that, of course, Bismarck was never in a position where things were anything like as complicated as they were by July 1914. That when he had to handle, let's say, the war with France in 1870, he is dealing with a much more narrow focus than the German Chancellor of 1914, Bethmann Hollweg, is having to deal with it. The alliances which emerge in the 1890s and strengthen and consolidate in the lead up to the war was seen by many at the time as a form of Cold War. In other words, just like NATO and the Warsaw Pact, that they could be used to deter each other, that they were actually helping keep the peace rather than promote war. Certainly the French Prime Minister and then President Poincaré took that view. He felt that everything should be done to make sure that the alliances were evenly balanced. And then there would be an armed truce like the Cold War, and war would not follow. When, of course, war does break out, or when the crisis of July 1914 leads up to war, then all the tensions which the alliance system had started kicking in, I believe that the crisis itself is crucial in explaining why this war breaks out, but it's also equally true to say that the alliance system has allowed tensions to fester, which then inform the way people behave when the crisis breaks in July 1914. The crisis itself is extraordinarily short. I mean, the Austrians deliver an ultimatum to Serbia on the 23rd of July, and within a week, Europe is at war. And I wonder whether Bismarck could have managed that, because you're in a Europe where communications are not instantaneous as they are now. You can't pick up the telephone and speak to your counterpart in another country. You can't send an email. What happens instead is you send a telegram which has to be encoded, sent, and then decoded, and almost certainly the clocks will have changed. You'll be in the wrong time. Somebody will have gone to bed. Somebody else will have got up. And the result is that all the statesmen of Europe are off the pace. They're behind the rate at which things are developing. So I don't know if Bismarck would actually have handled the situation, but it's also equally true to say that there is no European statesman in 1914 of Bismarck's stature.
That is one of the things that that I'm sure a lot of people find difficult to understand, how it is that what started out in being this localized conflict between Austro-Hungary and Serbia so quickly, almost like the proverbial dominoes following, managed to drag in Germany, France, Russia, Britain, all of these nations that, and some of them, I'm sure, would have looked at the precipitating conflict, the British, for example, they would say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with us. We got no dog in this fight. And yet somehow, within such a short period of time, they had committed their nations to the conflict on this scale.
Absolutely. It is extraordinary. I mean, there are so many accounts at the beginning of July 1914 when people are on holiday, when the sun is shining, and they say, who is this guy who's been killed in the Balkans, this Archduke, and what does it mean for us? Nothing. We go on with our lives, it's happened at the other side of Europe, and it's another Balkan struggle. There have been two Balkan wars in the previous 2 years anyway, and nothing much happened to the rest of Europe because of that. Why should anything happen now? And I think the answer to that is a twofold one. One, of course, is that nobody in 1914 believes that Vienna, as the capital of Austria-Hungary, acts without the support of Germany, that Germany must be behind Austria-Hungary. And it's certainly true that Germany has said to the Austrians, we will support you if you decide to take action against Serbia after the assassination of the Archduke. But they don't do much more than that, the Germans. They say they'll support them, but they're not orchestrating. They're not pulling the strings. It is up to the Austrians to do what they want to do. And there is still a hope, I think, on everybody's part that this will be a local war where Austria deals with its Balkan problem and deals with it quickly, and then everyone can go back to where they were. What unhinges that calculation is the response of Russia. Russia was humiliated in a crisis over Bosnia in 1908-09, and the liberals within Russia, strong pan-Slavs, believe that Russians should support Slavs everywhere, and the Tsar is not in a position, not in a strong enough position to be able to resist that pressure that he should declare support for Serbia. And the moment Russia is implicated, then the fact that Germany has given the support which it did give to the Austrians comes into play. The Austrians are looking to the Germans to keep Russia off. It's even possible then that the idea of deterrence might have operated, that Russia confronted with a threat from Germany, and Germany equally confronted with a threat from Russia, might have stood off, each might have deterred the other. But that, of course, isn't what happened. One of the issues here is the speed of mobilization in the last 2 or 3 days of the crisis, because Germany, as I'm sure you know, Germany is confronting the danger of a two-front war, of fighting France, because France is allied to Russia, if it's going to fight Germany. In other words, it can't just fight Russia on its own. So it's a complicated business. But it's a classic story, really, of one thing leading to another, and you're not being able to predict the outcome. Somebody once put to me as the Yogi Bear problem, that when you come to a fork in the road, you take it. The trouble is, which fork?
We have some other callers here. Let's go next to someone else in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. One is about the invasion of Gallipoli, whether that could have worked, whether that might have been successful. The other question is about the Armenian genocide, to what extent World War I was a cause of that, and what effect the genocide had on the way that the Ottoman Empire waged war or on the way that the opponents of the Ottoman Empire fought?
Both very good questions and very important ones. Gallipoli first. It's become fashionable in Britain to say that Gallipoli could never have achieved anything, that Churchill, who was the prime mover in the Gallipoli expedition, exaggerated the likely consequences, and that Turkey wouldn't simply have dropped out of the war just because British warships managed to get through the straits and into the Black Sea, or open the route up to Russia, or stand off the shore facing Istanbul. I think that that underplays what the significance of success at Gallipoli would have been, could have led to. The Turks were deeply divided about entering the war in the first place, and I think that the possibility of a coup within Istanbul, for example, if the British had been successful, is not to be discounted. Moreover, getting a warm water route into Russia, being able to supply Russia as the major ally in the east, and being able to give it the equipment which its armies demanded, that could have had a big impact on the war. So I believe Gallipoli is profoundly important.
Okay.
And one of the reasons I think it's profoundly important, it links into your second question about the Armenians. One of the reasons it's profoundly important is that Germany, confronted with a war with Britain, is at a loss as to how to deal with Britain. It can't get at Britain because of the Channel. It hasn't got a strong enough navy. And one solution for it is to have Turkey as an ally and use Turkey as the instrument for jihad, for holy war, and to spread that holy war across Central Asia to India of course, into North Africa. And the call to holy war doesn't actually pay off. But if the link from Germany through to Turkey and on eastwards is broken at Gallipoli, then that whole strategy is undermined. So for Germany, at the beginning of 1915, Gallipoli seems to be a very important theater of operations, because it has the capacity to break off what appears to be the only viable strategy for dealing with Britain. I said it linked into the Armenian question because one justification which the Turks have produced for the massacre of the Armenians is that the Ottoman Empire is under a desperate attack and desperate threat at the beginning of 1915. Turkey is fighting a war on four fronts. It's fighting in 1915. It's fighting at Gallipoli. It's fighting also in the north, but to the east of the empire, that is in the Caucasus against the Russian army. It's fighting in the southeast because there is a British force landed in Iraq, and it's fighting in the southwest because the Germans want it to threaten the Suez Canal, which, of course, is also the link between Britain and India.
Right.
So it's got a war on four fronts, and then, of course, the worry is, what is the enemy within? What is the enemy can threaten Turkey's lines of communications? And they turn into the Christian Armenian population. Now, the war, whether the war is the precipitant of that, whether the war is just the excuse, what the relationship is between the war and the Turkish desire to remove the Armenian population is a hotly debated question, highly controversial still today. There will be those who will say that because they have massacred Armenians before, the Turks are simply using the war as an excuse to finish off the problem. And there will be others who will say, look at the military situation, look how desperate the situation of the Ottoman army seems to be in 1915 with this war on two fronts and the problems of internal communication in a backward country, which Turkey is. And you can see why they feel impelled to turn on the Armenians, why they can interpret whatever the Armenians do as revolution. Having said all that, as I'm sure you know, what then happens to the Armenian population goes way beyond the argument for military necessity, because women, children, they are just as caught up in this massacre as men, and it's Armenians who are well away from the theater of operations, well away from the eastern Anatolian provinces where the Armenians who are concentrated, who get caught up in this. Calculations to the number of Armenians who are killed still vary enormously, but you'd be quite safe to say of the order of 1 million. So the two questions link. Gallipoli increases the sense in the Ottoman Empire that it's under threat, and the fear of the enemy within therefore becomes even stronger.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, maybe I can have a quick question and then a longer one. The quick one is, I don't know if you've heard, but there's the idea going around that the influenza attack of 1918 can be traced to a British military installation that was keeping pigs in a base in France. I was just curious if you'd heard that.
I hadn't heard that. But the influenza epidemic begins in India, as I understand it, and then moves west. Mm-hmm. This would be a local outbreak, or is this? This is all related to worries about chicken flu and so on as well. Presumably, that is linked to that. There was some speculation I read the other day about exhuming a victim of the influenza epidemic in order to look at and understand more about the nature of the disease, and then concerns, of course, that if they did that they would have it on their hands once more. But of course, this is like the First World War itself. This is a very relevant question, isn't it? As we sit waiting for another influenza pandemic that could be just as disastrous as the one of 1918-1919.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know exactly how it started, but I guess it's lost to history. But I wanted to ask you about a couple of themes that I've heard from non-British authors in various locations. And one is that I've heard it argued that World War One is a good argument against preemptive war, because World War One itself was the preemptive war, and it was basically brought about because of fear of German domination, basically, and that World War One begat World War Two, begat, you know, Korean War and blah blah blah.
Yep.
And that Churchill, and here's another thing that I wanted to run by you and get your take on it, is that Churchill apparently was very pro getting into World War One, and that fueled a lot of his desire and drive when he saw that the consequences, you know, came to World War II, and he felt like, you know, like in some guilt, I imagine, for the whole thing. And I just wanted to run that by you and see if you could comment on those things. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks very much. Well, deal with Churchill first, because I think that's easier than the preemption issue. Churchill certainly was excited by war. He loved war. He writes to his wife when the First World War breaks out and says, you know, I'm all charged up, happy, I know what I have to do, and full of vim and vigor. He's not responsible in any sense for bringing the war on, because in 1914 he is the first Lord of the Admiralty, i.e. the senior, the Minister for the Navy in Britain. And his own view, and this is a view reflected in Germany too, was that the Anglo-German naval arms race was as cool and relaxed as it had been for some time in 1914. So I think he responds to the crisis more than creates it. His one responsibility in July 1914 was to decide not to demobilized the fleet. The fleet had been on exercises, and the reservists were all with the ships. And rather than send them home, when he realized, of course, it would be then be very hard to call them back again, in July 1914, he keeps them on the ships and then eventually, of course, orders the ships to Scarpa Flow. And it's an interesting illustration of how you can use sea power without being provocative, that mobilizing the armies is a big part of the intensification of the July crisis. The navies are, in a way, mobilized sooner and move sooner, but it doesn't have the same impact for international relations. And it's worth thinking about that when people talk today about the flexibility of sea power and how you can use it in international relations. As far as the Second World War was concerned, of course, Churchill's role in the lead-up to the Second World War was to warn very much about the German threat and to oppose appeasement. And he, therefore, there is no sense, if you like, of guilt or responsibility in relation to the First World War, rather the reverse, a recognition that Germany was a real threat and should be faced up to. And he puts himself out on a political limb when he does that. What I've just said, of course, about Churchill and the Navy leads into your question about preemption. You're absolutely right. The preemption is a feature of the July crisis. The fear for many countries in 1914 is that war is going to come. And the crucial question, if war is going to come, is when do you fight it? Is it not better to fight it when you're more likely to win it than to leave it and leave it to a point where you might not win it? And that is a particularly powerful argument in Germany, where there is this fear of Russia. Russia is seen by all the European powers in 1914 as getting stronger all the time, as having these tremendous resources of manpower and raw materials. And the feeling is that once Russia is fully industrialized, then Russia will dominate Eastern and Central Europe and will be unstoppable. So from the German point of view, if you accept that argument, then it's better to have war now rather than have war later. You're more likely to win it now than you are later. So there is an argument of preemption there. Just as for Austria, too, the fear is that if you don't deal with Serbia, if you don't deal with the other powers on Austria's borders who have ethnic populations who aspire to control territory which is within the frontiers of Austria-Hungary, if you don't deal with that now, the problem's only going to get worse. So better to deal with it sooner rather than later. So if you're thinking about precedents for preemption, the First World War is a good one, but an equally, of course, a terrible warning of the dangers of preemption.
Yeah. I mentioned that I had talked with Robert Massey about Castles of Steel.
Yes.
A book that I know that you know because I saw your review. And it's a book that looks at the naval battles between Germany and Britain. And Massey makes this argument that says that this was key to the overall result of the conflict. And he sort of makes this argument that says the fact that Germany could not prevail on the surface leads them to put more influence on submarine warfare, and this ultimately for them disastrous decision to indiscriminately attack shipping in the Atlantic, which resulted in bringing the United States into the war, and their entry into the war ultimately meant that Germany lost.
Yep.
I think that's essentially the argument that he makes. I wonder what you think about that, and then overall the importance of the naval component of the war.
Yeah, I think that's all a perfectly sustainable and fair argument. There is probably even a further rider to it as well, which is that after the war, Germany calculated that it had lost of the order of 750,000 civilians to the effects of the blockade. Which of course depended on sea power. British sea power is doing is underpinning the naval blockade, which is preventing Germany trading with the rest of the world. So Germany can't import additional foodstuffs. Germany is almost self-sufficient in foodstuffs, but not wholly so. And therefore, after 1918, in Britain, people turn around and say, well, sea power won the war. there may not have been a big naval, a decisive naval battle fought at Jutland. It may have been, in tactical terms, a draw, or even possibly some Germans argued, of course, in the immediate aftermath of Jutland, that it was a defeat. But the crucial thing was that Britain remained in control of the seas, and when Britain remained in control of the seas, then the blockade could be enforced. And it is that loss of civilian life and the revolution that takes place at the end of the war which ultimately explains the German defeat. And this is a very powerful argument in the 1920s and 30s for Britain, because what it says is you don't need to put an army on the continent again. You don't need to fight a European war like that. You don't need any more battles of the Somme or battles of Verdun. You need sea power to do the job instead. So it goes in two different directions. It goes both to the direction, well, it's sea power that ultimately is responsible for bringing the U.S. into the war, and it goes into the direction that that says that sea power is the decisive element in warfare. Now, both those things, of course, have very powerful counter-arguments advanced against them, and I suppose in relation to the Massey argument, the powerful counter-argument that I would explore is, why does the U.S. enter the war? What is it that drives Woodrow Wilson to make that decision? And I would see the German declaration of unrestricted U-boat warfare as the precipitant, the thing that enables Wilson to justify what he's doing to the U.S. public, because U.S. ships and U.S. civilians are at danger as a result of the direct variation of unrestricted U-boat warfare. But I wouldn't see it as the thing that is really driving Wilson, because I think Wilson is an idealist who does have a vision of a new international order. And by the winter of 1916-17, even independently of the declaration of unrestricted U-boat warfare, he has realized that the United States has to get into this war if it's going to be able to shape the post-war world and the post-war settlement.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Hugh Strawn. He's professor of history at Oxford, has written a great deal about World War I, and is the author of a one-volume history entitled The First World War. It was produced as a companion to a British television documentary series on the war. It's available here in the United States, published by Viking, if you'd like to look at it. And we have some other callers here, and we'll get right back to them. Champaign County, Line 3. Hello.
I wonder about the naval attitude, or the attitude of naval power in Britain, because years ago I had a professor who claimed that when Chamberlain got off his plane and proclaimed peace in his time, he waved a piece of paper that represented a naval agreement with Germany, and that. If your discussion earlier was an influence in Chamberlain's thinking at that time, was Navy a concern in negotiating with Hitler?
Yes, it was. You're absolutely right. I mean, the Munich Agreement 1938 did not pivot on the naval issue, but you're absolutely right that when Chamberlain came back, he referred to the Anglo-German Naval Agreement as one of the underpinnings of the possibility of decent relations with Germany. The Anglo-German Naval Agreement, and of course the United States was involved in this whole business of naval arms limitation talks in the 1920s and 30s.
There are many attempts at naval regulation.
Absolutely, and they focused very largely, of course, on surface ship numbers. And one of the interesting things in the interwar period was the attitude to the submarine, because very few people could imagine the submarine having quite the same effect in a future war as it had had in the First World War. They felt it had been the advantage of a new technology, and that anti-submarine warfare would be more effective in the next war than it had been in the previous one. They were dead wrong, of course, but it was it's one of the reasons why, ironically, the Germans in the 1930s get suckered into developing pocket battleships because they think if there's going to be a British blockade in the next war, they'll have to use those battleships to break the blockade. When, in hindsight, of course, if they put even more resources into developing U-boats, the Battle of the Atlantic would have been an even closer rung thing and might have gone the other way.
Let me ask about the prelude to war. And I was going to ask a before and after sequence, but now it's after and before. The Socialist International collapsed when the German socialists voted for war credits.
Yes.
What was the thinking of the German socialists at that time? How did they fail? How did they break ranks of the Brotherhood?
A very, very good question. The problem for any socialist party, and a particularly powerful problem for the German socialists in 1914, is, are you opposing your own country, or are you on your own country's side? And if you oppose your own country, that essentially makes you a revolutionary party. In 1914, the German Socialist Party is the largest party in the Reichstag. It's the largest party in the German parliament. It doesn't have an overall majority, but it seems that by working with the grain of politics in Germany rather than against the grain of politics, that it's becoming more influential and more powerful. Now, that doesn't mean that it's ready to support Germany in any war that it chooses to fight, but it manages to conclude that this war is a defensive war for Germany. This is a war of national self-defense, and it does that precisely because of Russia's involvement. That Russia is going to attack into East Prussia. He's going to do that, of course, in support of Serbia, because Serbia is dealing with the Austrians. But by seeing the war as a war of national self-defense, then in the eyes of all but a minority of the German socialists, this is a justified war. This is a war of national self-defense. And I think it's crucial that we realize that, because it's one of the reasons why Germany can be united during this war and remain united during it and committed to it right up until 1918, that basically the party that represents the German people is behind the war.
Oh, I have some other callers here, just about 5 minutes left. I hope the caller will forgive me if I try to get at least one more, and we'll go to Chicago for the next in line. That's line 4. Hello.
Hi. I just went ahead. I had a question about the long-term repercussions of World War One. I'm not sure whose thesis it is, but basically he argued that the English public was so disillusioned by World War One that when World War Two came around, people saw it as another imperial war. And in order to get the public behind the war effort, they introduced the beverage plan. And then, including when Roosevelt got in, the U.S. got into the war, there was the rhetoric about the four freedoms. And the result was a labor government for some years, and also expectation in the colonies of that they would also be liberated. And so it hastened the crumbling of the British Empire. And I just wanted your comments on that.
Well, I think that in the long run, both wars clearly do hasten the crumbling of the British Empire. I think that's entirely true. I put the emphasis on the long run, and you can ask whether that would have happened anyway. The beverage plan and the whole idea of providing welfare for Britain grows out of the war rather than the run-up to the war. Once Britain is in the Second World War, there is an awareness that the people have to have something back for the effort that is being asked of them. Lloyd George had promised at the end of the First World War that Britain would become a land fit for heroes. And what actually had happened, of course, was economic depression and ultimately the end of the 20s, the slump. So the feeling was that these men had come back from the war and had faced disillusionment and depression. And that was not to happen after 1945. So there is a real effort to create a better Britain, which is planned during the course of the Second World War. And it's an interesting illustration, I think, of how Britain in particular, and I think it is Britain in particular, takes the lessons of the First World War when it fights the Second World War. There is a real sense that its government departments do many of the things which they have learned from the First World War, and impose them very quickly on the Second World War in all sorts of ways, in terms of the management of war production, in terms of how it fights the economic war, in terms of how it manages its manpower. All these issues are ones that it has addressed between 1914 and 1918, and now it does again.
Thank you.
All right, we'll try to get one more call here. We'll go to our Indiana caller here on line 1. Hello.
Yes, I wish you'd say something about the generation that was lost with the war. I'm thinking about Sassoon and the poets in particular, but I'm sure there are other intellectuals and leaders, you know, presumed leaders to come. If you could say something about that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Professor Tron, I can give you about a minute to do that. So we could write, I'm sure one could write volumes.
Well, the quick answer is, demographically, there isn't a lost generation. The population recovers very quickly. But that emotionally, and particularly for the British middle classes, of course, there is. And that is enormously important in terms of how they see war, that war has caused this loss. And of course, it does affect public attitudes in the 1930s.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to that question I asked way at the beginning about whether there were ways in which people yet today in Britain still feel touched by World War One in a way that probably here in the United States we don't.
Absolutely. And it's Sassoon and Owen who shaped that. I would make the point, particularly in relation to Owen, that what he's talking about is war as a disaster for humanity anytime, anywhere. That, in other words, it's a universal statement as much as a statement about the First World War in particular.
Yeah. Well, there is so much that we have not talked about, really not all that much about the conduct of the war and other ways in which the war shaped the world as it is now. The Middle East certainly is one very prominent example that we could maybe I'd better not, because
well, it's extraordinary we haven't talked about it, isn't it?
I appreciate very much your giving us some of your time today and talking with us.
Not at all. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you very much indeed.
Our guest, Hugh Strawn, is a professor of the history of war and fellow of All Souls College, Oxford University. He is editor of the Oxford History of the First World War. He is writing a 3-volume history of the First World War, and that first volume in that series has been published. That came out in 2001, so if you're interested in reading in depth, you can look at that book. And then if you'd like to have a 1-volume history of the war, an overview of the war, look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled The First World War, and that book is published by Viking. By the way, if you go and look for the book, his last name is spelled Strachan, pronounced Strawn, Hugh Strawn. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor. Tomorrow morning on our program in hour number one, we will be talking about Africa, and our guest there is Howard French. He's a senior writer for the New York Times, and we'll be discussing his book, A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa. And then in hour two, Jeffrey Hollander talks about his book, a different sort of focus. It's titled What Matters Most, How a Small Group of Pioneers is Teaching Social Responsibility to Big Business and Why Big Business is Listening. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And we hope right now that you will stay tuned, because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, and the host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with the authors of Half Breed, the remarkable true story of George Bent, caught between the worlds of the Indian and the white man. That's coming up today following the 1 o'clock news. It's